you are.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans love to roll the dice, spin the wheel, try their luck. Their slots and dollar scratch tickets and bets on games add up to nearly $1 trillion a year in wagers. Against staggering odds, why do so many people continue to place their money on the table for a shot at the jackpot? Tonight on Point, America's gambling boom. We begin in America's capital of gambling in all its plumed and sequined splendor, Las Vegas. In the 1930s, Nevada kicked off America's casino era, luring gamblers to the desert with cheap hotel rooms, cheap food, and showgirls that glittered. Today, Las Vegas welcomes millions who drop billions to test their luck. Earlier, I spoke with the man at the helm of the city, Las Vegas Mayor Oscar Goodman. Now that Americans have thousands of ways to gamble, from riverboats and tribal casinos to lotteries and the internet, I asked him, how does Las Vegas stack up?
You know, I think the truth of the matter is, I think these other places have helped us. It's gotten people used to gambling, so it's not something foreign to them. And then they think of Las Vegas as being the real thing. So they come to the icon, and it dwarfs what they have locally.
And what does the icon stand for today? You've got tribal casinos pulling in 40,000 customers a day. What sets Las Vegas apart now?
Well, the fact is that you go from one casino to another. When you go to the Indian reservations and when you go to these outlying areas where they have gambling, you usually have one or two casinos if you're lucky. Here, you have one experience after another. You start off at the top of the strip and you go from Paris to Rome to Egypt. I mean, it just doesn't stop here. It's a fun place. It's an adult playland. It's a wonderland. And these other places aren't. They're just places where you go there, you get a buffet, gamble a little bit of money, and you go home.
Mayor Goodman, we know that the Las Vegas industry took a nosedive last fall after 9/11 and the fear about flying. But what's the overall trend?
We've come back virtually all the way. Our conventions are back. The hotels are full, 95% occupancy during the weekend, during the week, in the 80s. I mean, any other place would be envious of us. The place is thriving. It's booming again, and the airplanes are full, and the highways are crowded.
With so many options out there, so much competition, so many gambling opportunities, can it continue to draw, to grow? What's the future look like for Las Vegas?
Well, we keep on reinventing ourselves. It's a very interesting community. When a hotel gets a little bit mature, we implode it. And it's like it was never there, and we put up something in its place that is even bigger and better than the ones that were there before it. We have geniuses here who invent these new themes and just draws people.
And Mayor Goodman, what's your sense of the future for gambling overall? It's reportedly at $866 billion a year that Americans now bet. How much bigger can it get?
Let's put it this way. What you're talking about is $860 billion. That's what they're betting in casinos. You can imagine what they're doing in Madison Square Garden and with their local bartender, with all the illegal bookmakers out there. Gambling is here to stay. I think it's a natural phenomenon. People like to take a chance. They like to take a risk. They like to see whether or not they could grab the carrot. So Vegas just represents the biggest place to gamble of all, and nobody will ever be able to catch up with us because we are so embedded with gambling, which is honest, which is well-regulated. Nobody's ever cheated here. You got a real chance to win on a level playing field, the best entertainment in the world.
We hear your enthusiasm, but let me ask you, is there such a thing for Las Vegas or for the country as too much gambling?
No, I don't think so. Not for Las Vegas, of course. You can't be oversaturated. People are just looking for new venues. They're looking to go back to the old places that they enjoy. And I really think that gambling is it's fun, it's relaxation, it's an outlet. And unless it's abused, and we look for that here, unless somebody has a problem, and we look for that here too, it's a wonderful way to spend your free time.
How do you deal with problem gamblers, with pathological gamblers or gambling addicts?
Well, the hotels actually have training, believe it or not. The casinos have training to spot folks who have a problem, and if they see there's somebody with a problem, they honestly take them aside and try to direct them to resources which address that problem. And we're very attentive to that.
And what about the biggest criminal threats related to gambling today? I know that before you became mayor, you were one of the top criminal defense attorneys in Las Vegas. You must have known intimately the criminal element there. How do you see crime relating to gambling today?
Well, in the old days when I was actively practicing law and I was in the movie Casino playing myself, there was a different Las Vegas. There was a different element that was here. Now all those people are either retired in cemeteries or in prison, and there's no organized crime element here whatsoever. I know that better than anybody because I represented them. So you can take it from me that you get an honest shake and there's nothing to worry about crime as far as gambling is concerned in Las Vegas.
I know you've been a promoter of actually a museum of the mafia or the mob. Is that coming?
Well, it's going to be a historical museum, and of course I'm a guy who doesn't implode. Unlike those who develop our hotels, I want to have our entire history represented here, and we've got an interesting history. We're different than any other place, and I like to play on that.
Do you see mobsters as pioneers?
As far as Las Vegas is concerned?
Yes.
Absolutely. The mob founded this place, and we thrived with them here. There are a lot of old-timers who would just soon have them back here. They feel that maybe they had a better life in those days, but the truth of the matter is we have a wonderful quality of life here now, and we don't need the mob to make sure that we're having a good time in Las Vegas.
And what about the morality of gambling? Are we all over that issue?
Oh, yes. I mean, no one's going to find gambling to be immoral. I mean, look at the other supposed vices that are out there. There's nothing wrong with having a good time, and that's what gambling is.
Mayor Goodman, thanks for joining us.
Okay, good talking to you.
Oscar Goodman is mayor of Las Vegas, Nevada. He joined us earlier from Las Vegas. America's love affair with gambling had to overcome enormous historical resistance. In the 1930s, Las Vegas, as we know it, was born with the first Nevada casino. In the 60s, New Hampshire introduced the first state lottery to solve a budget crunch. In the 70s, the casinos of Atlantic City offered New Jersey a lifeline out of recession. Now, from lottery tickets at the convenience store, casinos within a day trip drive, and internet betting 24 hours a day, gambling has never been more convenient or pervasive. And while revenues continue to soar, so does the pathology, including gambling addiction. A recent study found that 4% of American adults have a problem with gambling, problems that can look a lot like alcoholism or cocaine addiction. What has moved America so deep into gambling country? And is there such a thing as too much gambling? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Richard McGowan. He's an economics professor at Boston College and author of, most recently, Government and the Transformation of the Gaming Industry. Good evening and welcome, Richard McGowan.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Richard McGowan, we've been throwing around these numbers, but help us have a more material sense of the scale and diversity of gambling in America today. What does the horizon, the skyline, look like?
Well, again, I think you have to break down the three segments of gambling. But as far as casino gambling now, that is since 1994, it is now the biggest segment of gambling. So you have casinos, the lotteries, and as you mentioned, pari-mutuel betting. The casinos now.
Pari-mutuel being track.
Tracks.
Dog track, racing, horse track.
Horse track. And that's the dying part of the industry. It's interesting. It's the casino part of the industry is the one that's really, really taking off. All right, Tom. So for instance, right now, there's one. Harrah's now claims that you're never more than 400 miles away from a Harrah's casino. No American lives more than 400 miles away from a Harrah's casino.
And we read that there are something now like 429 casinos in 11 states around the country.
There's around 27 states that have some. That would be 11 privately owned. There's 27 states.
Oh, and that would not include
Native American
casinos.
If you include Native American, there's 27 states that have some form of casino gambling in them now. 38 states run lotteries, plus the District of Columbia. And there's only – right now there are three states that don't have some form of legalized gambling. I think it's Hawaii, believe it or not, which is kind of – and that's a big issue there. Obviously Utah. And then the final state's Tennessee, and that's becoming a big issue in Tennessee right now.
Give us a sense of the history. Here we are edging toward $1 trillion wagered annually in the United States. If you could roll back the tape a century, how do you think Americans would have responded to the idea that we would become a hyper-gambling nation?
Well, I mean, if we went back to our forefathers, remember that the James colony that founded Virginia was built on lottery tickets.
Lottery tickets issued
in England. And ironically, the English crown found that the lottery was too successful. It was stealing money from them, did away with it, which is one of the reasons why the initial colony, the Jamestown colony, didn't make it, because they ran out of money.
What was the prize in the lottery?
Well, I mean, again, normally they were privately run lotteries, so it would be the equivalent of our old 50-50 tickets. In other words, 50 cents went to the lottery operator, and 50 mm-hmm. cents went back to the bettor, which are got awful odds, to say the least. So, in other words, it was kind of like a charity thing.
But that's certainly going right back to really the very beginning.
So,
but we have a sense of there being some period in America's history where this was really an enormous taboo. It was on a par with visiting prostitutes or living the drunken life. That it was simply outside, beyond the pale of what was accepted moral upright activity.
And that the last state lotteries were run in the 1840s. Then it became outlawed because of various cheating scandals. There were all kinds of scandals. But remember, early in the American history experience, Thomas Jefferson thought it was the best form of voluntary taxation. And in fact, Jefferson himself paid off all his one way he himself was going bankrupt near his death. And so he ran a lottery for himself to try to pay off his debts.
So you're telling me that before the period in which this was frowned upon, it actually had a rich history in American culture.
But a very different history. In that the state allowed you to run a lottery. For instance, so Harvard College ran a lottery to build
not to get in, but to raise money.
To raise money, okay. The Erie Canal was built that way. So, but it was in other words, there was a public good. The state permitted you to run a one-time lottery. But that was it. Once you did the public good, then the lottery ceased.
Mm-hmm.
And so that lasted up to 1840, when there were some real scandals. The Washington Monument, by the way, was initially financed through a lottery, and the person absconded with all the funds and ran to Mexico.
You're kind of blowing my mind with these examples. Jamestown, the Washington Monument, Thomas Jefferson. It's like, was Mount Rushmore built on lottery?
No, that was a little later on, Tom. But clearly, what I'm saying here, up to 1840, and then it was, it became a real taboo. People said that you can't run an honest lottery, so forget it. The only other time that happened was the state of Louisiana after the Civil War tried to raise money, and they ran the first national lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a precursor of what happens now, because immediately the other states said, they're stealing money from us.
Right.
Now, the difference was the states then said, we're not going to get in the lottery business, but we're going to get the federal government to outlaw that you can sell lottery tickets through the mail. And so that was the last.
That shut down the national lottery.
And lotteries basically died out.
And then we fast forward almost to Nevada in the 30s.
I would say a little bit before you get to Nevada in the 30s, you talk about in the late 20s, right, when Maryland and Kentucky had horse racing, paramutual
betting.
So
we're back at the track.
And again, there was a technological innovation there. All of a sudden, you had the tote board. You could actually do this. Up to mm-hmm. that time, it was a gentleman's kind of bet. But now, all of a sudden, and horse racing was sold as, again, I think here's another significance. Horse racing was sold as a sport. It was an entertainment. It was a sport.
Well, and we're back to that in many ways, aren't we?
Oh, yeah.
Richard
McGowan,
I have to ask you, can you imagine that Americans could have imagined 50 years ago, even 20 years ago, that we would be at the scale of wagering in this country that we're at today, nearing $1 trillion a year?
No. I don't think anybody for sure. I think most people, even 20 years ago, thought the market was saturated. And obviously, as the good mayor of Nevada,
Las Vegas
said, it hasn't. You do wonder how much further it can go. But obviously, right now, we've yet to have a casino declare bankruptcy. So I can tell you, people do like to take the risk. And enjoy it.
We are talking tonight about gambling gone wild, about American wagering approaching $1 trillion a year. The question is there such a thing as too much gambling? Have we reached that point? Are you a gambler? Has it made you richer or poorer? Does gambling, America's new best friend, is it a government revenue bonanza, or is it a tax on stupidity stacked against the players? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Love. duck, let a gentleman see just how nice a dame I can be.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about gambling gone wild in the United States, where wagers will reportedly approach $1 trillion in the next year. And the question is there still an objection on moral grounds to gambling, or are we over all that? Are we all gamblers now? And beneath that, why have we become such a nation of gamblers? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Richard McGowan. He's a professor of economics at Boston College, author most recently of Government and the Transformation of the Gaming Industry. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-TALK. Richard McGowan, the state, the government is now deeply involved in gambling. You've given us some examples from history where that's happened before, but never on this kind of scale. Do we have, in effect, the government becoming the biggest sponsor, the biggest purveyor of gambling at this point, or through all the lottery advertising, its biggest marketer?
The lottery obviously is operated by the state, and that and clearly there the state governments are the chief beneficiaries, and they're also the worst bets that are being made of all the gambling.
The odds are worse for the participants.
By far. And so it is a way you mentioned earlier. I say the lottery is for the mathematically illiterate.
This is the tax on the stupid theory.
Well, yeah, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, the best lottery game will get back around 60%. The worst casino game gets back 91%. So, I mean, clearly the odds against the better in a lottery game are enormous. Now, the state, the state for the most part is trying to make it sound like that when you play a lottery game, you're doing it for the good of society.
Isn't that true? That 40% of the haul that goes off to the state is put into schools, hospitals,
right.
Roads, what?
And you must, is that the appropriate way of raising money for things that the state should be sponsoring? So, for instance, in Massachusetts, the lottery is used for aid to local towns and cities, Tom. And that's a wonderful thing. There's no doubt about that. Now,
so is it a civic act when you scratch the ticket?
Well, I would probably say, it is, but I would also say it's a regressive civic act because you're clearly it's the people who are playing the lotteries are paying an inordinate amount of money to get the thrill of playing the lottery. And again, I get the casino the lottery games themselves, the instant games are played by the younger crowd. The daily number is played by the elderly and the poor. And that is really the daily, and which is the worst odds that the lottery gives back. So the two groups that can least afford get the worst odds on the way back.
And how important is the revenue from state lotteries now to state governments around this country? We know this is a very difficult time for state governments on the fiscal front. Is it a significant portion of their revenue? Is it a critical portion of their revenue?
It's not. I mean, for most states, I would probably say it's less than 3 to 4% of their total revenue. So it's not. So it's not a it's a significant thing in the sense that it's a very discretionary income for states. They can decide to spend this money any way they want. So from the political end, it's a wonderful thing. You don't have to tax anybody, mm-hmm. and you can fund your little goody things the way you want. And so, for instance, Georgia's a classic example. They just came in with a lottery. They privatized their lottery, by the way. GTEC runs their lottery. And the proceeds are used to fund college scholarships. Every Georgia college student gets at least $1,200 from the lottery mm-hmm. as a scholarship. Mm-hmm. Well, that's great PR. I mean, it's just great PR for this. But
it means they can put up the biggest billboards in the state, and who can complain because it's for the good of the students.
Yes, it is. And so they're.
And yet somebody's losing, as you say, in a regressive.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
so it's an interesting, you know, I guess one of the things here, does the ends justify the means? And that's an interesting. Now, people will say, well, if the state doesn't provide that lottery, they're going to bet anyways. illegally. And so there is the argument. The argument is people are going to bet anyway, so the state won't get its hand in it.
And how about that? At this point, what percentage of overall wagering in America goes into lotteries, and what goes into private and tribal casinos?
Well, again, the biggest segment now is casino gambling. The lotteries since 1993, the lotteries have fell behind the casinos. And so the casino now is they're probably have got at least 40% of the market, if not bigger than that.
So the casino's the biggest single chunk.
Oh, sure.
And the state portion, what percentage roughly?
With the lotteries, you're talking probably around a third.
Hmm. So it's really two-thirds that's not going in any portion.
Oh, sure.
To schools, roads, et cetera. It's just an industry and an enormous industry. Listeners, you can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Is there such a thing as too much gambling, and have we reached that point? Bill's calling from Crandon, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I've been on both sides of the argument. I worked as a security officer and a surveillance officer at an Indian-run casino for over 5.5 years.
So how do you see it after that experience, Bill?
Well, I will say that the casinos do bring a tremendous amount of money into a community that was relying only on things like timber and also the tourist industry.
Right.
And also, I've seen the other side of the coin again, because we used to have people that would come into the casinos 7 days a week, and on occasion you would have to ask somebody to get off a machine because they've been on it for 10 and 12 hours with not eating, you know.
Good Lord.
And I also saw one gentleman spend $15,000 of his own money in a dollar machine in order to win 10 grand. I've seen it all, you know.
Bill, let me ask you. Gambling is presented as the new American entertainment. When you were there as a security guard and a surveillance function, as you watched the people flow through that casino, were these happy, healthy Americans on a good, entertaining lark? Or what was the kind of – how would you characterize the population doing the gambling?
Well, I will say that we had people that were in there 7 days a week who were retired and had nothing better to do. I've also seen groups of people that came in, and they usually hit the blackjack tables, and they're a bunch of guys or a bunch of couples that will come for the entertainment part. But I think generally speaking, people are going in there hoping against hope to win money, because these are the people that need it the most. You'll see them in there all the time.
Bill, thank you for your call. Richard McGowan, what about this issue? Bill raises it from his personal experience of gambling addiction or pathological gambling. How much of the population does that affect, and what are the symptoms? We read that it's increasingly seen as akin to drug addiction.
The estimates are around 4 or 5% of the population will have a gambling problem.
The population of gamblers or the overall population?
The overall population.
So that's a pretty big number.
Now, the addiction part is around 1.2% of the population. So notice you have a certain percentage, which is obviously much larger, that's going to be that will have a problem with gambling and get it over on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the 1.2% that Bill was describing there, and the caller was describing there, who are going to need help. Again, I think there's the interesting thing. Does the state really provide enough help for the people?
What are the symptoms of this kind of pathological gambling addiction? Describe to us, what is that life like?
I think very much a little bit what the previous caller said, that somebody he'll go in 7 days a week, at least the casinos. That would be more typical, and again, there's a gender difference a little bit. I would probably say there are probably more females that do the casino, the person will sit at the slot machine for 10 hours and things like that. The typical male can get addicted to mine. It can also do the slot machine. But the typical male is much more into the sports betting, the illegal sports betting. And somehow they think that they can learn enough knowledge to beat the odds on that.
We read that in the journal Neuron that recently, they're saying that the same neural circuitry is involved in the highs and lows of winning money, abusing drugs, or anticipating a gastronomical treat. It makes it sound like it's almost something in human nature, in the biology of human nature, that makes some people susceptible to this kind of addictive syndrome.
Yes, and that's... I've actually witnessed that once. And the person, in other words, It's not for the money. The reason, ironically, it's not for the money why they're gambling. It's the high of taking the risk, and that's what really turns them on, taking the risk and doing it that way. And so I think it's hard for somebody who's not addicted to kind of sit there and say, how could you be addicted? And yet when you do watch an addictive gambler and the high they get from winning – It's a remarkable sight.
Almost like cocaine or heroin addiction.
Oh, it definitely is.
Richard McGowan, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now Jan Jones. She's a senior vice president at Harrah's Entertainment. She's a former mayor of Las Vegas until 1999. Good evening and welcome, Jan Jones.
Thank you.
Jan Jones, we're talking tonight about the incredible phenom of gambling and its incredible growth in the United States. And the question we're asking callers, I guess it's fair to put to you as well. Obviously, there's been an enormous change in American attitudes toward gambling and American participation in gambling. Is there such a thing, Jan Jones, as someone who's in the gambling business, is there such a thing as too much gambling?
You know, it's a very interesting question, and I've been listening to both the callers and the discussion as you were approaching mm-hmm. it. And there's the interesting thing about gambling today is that it has really evolved into an acceptable form of entertainment. 67% of the American public, whether they gamble or not, feel that it's appropriate appropriate for people to gamble.
And we see that the number who think it's not moral is down to something like 25%.
Exactly. And, you know, when you talk about compulsive gambling and addictions, and, you know, actually the Harvard School of Addictions estimates the percentage of pathological gamblers or gamblers with a real problem, mm-hmm. it's somewhere between 0.5% to 1.5% of the population.
Who are really deep into it, deeply into it that like alcoholics, they sometimes experience blackouts, periods of time where they have no idea what they've been doing.
Right. And there's very high level of comorbidity, mm-hmm. meaning that if you tend to be an addictive gambler, you're probably addicted or have a tendency to be addicted to alcohol, drugs, shopping. You know, it's an addictive behavior that is not specific necessarily to gambling.
So casino companies, like tobacco companies, like alcohol or beverage companies, have to deal with the fact that a part of their customer base is going to have a very unhealthy relationship with their product.
Right. The only distinction I would make there is when you look at cigarettes, 98% of the public who picks up a cigarette is going to be addicted. We know that. 98% of the public who mm-hmm. chooses to gamble is not going to be addicted. You know, so, you know, aligning those two mm-hmm. is, you know, they're significantly different.
Jan Jones, between being mayor of Las Vegas and being with Harrah's now, you've been related to this industry for a long time. But let's look at that 98%. Okay, let's say they won't be addicted. But the question still arises there, even there, in the broad swath of Americans who have come to see it as entertainment, is there a downside in this? Is there such a thing as too much gambling as the numbers climb up and up and up? Is there a point at which this is simply destructive somehow, or not? Is it just entertainment, and it's just like watching a baseball game?
I think it's just entertainment, and I really have come to believe that. I think the majority of Americans gamble responsibly. I think they gamble within a budget. I think that, and we've seen this both with our customers. You know, Harrah's high roller meaning big gambler, mm-hmm. gambles on an average of $1,500 a year. You know, that's probably less than Americans and, you know, in that same economic group are spending on restaurants, movies. It's a choice.
And that's a high roller in the Harrah's casino world.
Right. You know, this is every day. We just finished a study that we conducted in conjunction with Roper that profiled who is the casino gambler. And what you find is they're better educated. They make more money. They're put more money aside for retirement. They're making a very cognizant decision in a very responsible manner. And I know when you were talking about Georgia and the model where they really dedicated the revenue to education, mm-hmm. which I think is a very good thing because the public knows where the money's going. If you didn't have that dedicated line, you know, eventually you're either not going to fund education or you're going to go and tax the public to pay for that education. At least here, they're making a conscious decision I want to pay this tax.
Richard McGowan, let me ask you about a couple things that Jan Jones has raised. First of all, this profile of the casino gambler as better educated than the ordinary Joe as or Joanne, as a little better off, more likely to be saving. Do you buy that? Does that make sense to you?
It does, actually. I mean, I think the casino attracts a different type of person than the lottery ticket in general.
All right. And then what about the characterization of gambling? And, of course, this has been done even in the way it's referred to, which very often now called the gaming industry. I think this is a kind of marketing shift probably authored by the industry itself. But in any case, is that an appropriate way to look at gambling? Is just another form of entertainment like going to the opera or going to a baseball game or watching a movie?
Well, I mean, certainly they have shifted the things to the gaming industry. And I think, you know, as you call, if it's a, it is part of the entertainment industry right now. I think one of the things you do wonder a little bit is how people are being. It says something culturally about how we're being entertained. And as somebody sitting mindlessly at a slot machine, you do wonder. I mean, I'll grant you that person's being entertained, and that's what they choose
to
do.
But let's compare it to a video game, which you can also sit mindlessly at.
Is it?
Yeah,
is it, but is it better or worse than a video game or movie? Or is there really no difference?
That's an interesting. I don't think anybody can. The way you want to be entertained sometimes. I mean, who's to say which is the better way of being entertained? I mean, but I do think it does say something about that. You know, people don't want to have to think when they're being entertained now, and so it's an interesting cultural thing.
Jan Jones, let me put the same question to you. I can imagine an old Calvinist work ethic tub thumper saying, you know, in the old days when we wanted to make some money, we worked hard, we were industrious to make that happen. For whatever reason, the new way to money is seen by many as gambling. Is that a diminution of the nation's moral fiber?
I don't think so. I think it's a reinforcement of this nation's belief that they have a right to make a conscious decision on how they choose to spend their money, and that someone shouldn't tell them how to think, how to act, how to be. And if they're gambling in a responsible manner and they find it entertaining and they're having fun, who are we to sit in judgment and say, no, we're sorry. We don't find that appropriate. Any more than someone should say, you know, you can only go to certain restaurants or you can only see certain movies or, you know, it almost goes against First Amendment rights.
Jan Jones, how much bigger can it get?
I think that it can. And then what you see now is, you know, racetracks looking to put in slot machines, which provides, you know, from that perspective, another form of entertainment for people who are already at a racetrack.
So maybe plenty bigger.
I think it can get bigger.
Jan, we're just about out of time. We're coming up to a break, but I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was a real pleasure.
Jan Jones is Senior Vice President for Harrah's Entertainment, a former mayor of Las Vegas. We're talking tonight about gambling gone wild in America, approaching $1 trillion a year in wagers. Why have we become a nation of gamblers? And what does it mean to be the gambling nation? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm a gambling man. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about gambling gone wild in America, about the Americans' tremendous infatuation with gambling, now reaching the scale of almost $1 trillion a year that are wagered. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. My guest tonight is Richard McGowan. He's a professor of economics at Boston College and author of Government and the Transformation of the Gaming Industry. He studied gambling, tobacco, and alcohol. It's all there. You can join us as well. Jerry's on the line. Welcome, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have so many issues I don't quite know where to start.
Jump in.
First of all, I think it makes a lot of sense to separate out casino gambling from things like the lottery and things that you just walk into your local convenience store.
Separate them out in terms of who benefits, where the revenue goes?
Well, I'm thinking in terms of who does it and
okay.
And also probably on the impact on people. I don't know about you. I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and where we have a phenomenal amount of state-sponsored gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't walk into a convenience store without being behind someone in line who is buying lottery tickets of some sort or another. And if you look at those folks, it's everybody. Now, you can't tell me, you know, you spoke earlier with a woman from Las Vegas who said, well, you know, they would, they'd do it anyways, whether, you know.
They'd find a way.
Mm-hmm. Right. They'd find a way. You can't tell me that, you know, a little, you know, 70-year-old gray-haired woman is going to go seek out a bookie.
So the state is a facilitator, no question.
Oh, absolutely. And furthermore, they're an advertiser of it. And that's what really galls me, is that my tax dollars, or perhaps it's the gaming dollars, whatever, are being used to lure people into activity that is ultimately not good for them.
But what is it exactly?
Tax.
So it's the regressive taxation part of it, the fact that the poor end up paying more through this tax, that is what galls you, Jerry?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because as I think your guest has pointed out, you know, the people who are better educated don't do this.
Jerry, thanks for your call. Richard McGowan, is that the case?
The only thing it's – I mean, I agree with Jerry. Unfortunately, Massachusetts doesn't allow any advertising for the lottery. There's no advertising for the lottery. But where I think, you know, he's made some really good points is that, you know, when you talk about gaming, and I think all three forms of gambling, they
you
all claim
there's no
to be
advertising,
games.
But there's so much signage for it in our lives that we feel like.
Oh, sure. But even more, to be quite honest, their best advertisement, by the way, for the lottery, by the way, the best advertisement is when the lotto game gets really huge and everybody's. Everybody hears, you know, that the thing hit $230 million
right.
And off we go.
But I interrupted you. Sorry, Richard McGowan.
But I mean, just getting back to the point where you think about a game has three characteristics. It should be fair. It should be honest, and you should be able to exit it. And one of the problems, and I probably should have said this earlier, even with casino gambling, it's just not fair. The bettors are not aware of what the rate of return is to them whatsoever.
I mean, how much
they're
of
actually
the
getting
is.
Back. I can't understand why, for instance, I think casinos should be forced to on a slot machine to be saying this is the percentage that's being repaid back.
Mm-hmm.
Same
so we're going to hold out 8% of this or 9% and the
same
rest,
thing
maybe
with the lottery
you have a chance
game. The lottery games, the odds of you winning that mm-hmm. lottery ticket should be posted right then and there and let people know at least that's the fair part of the game.
Honesty?
Honesty. It's just an honesty. Well, clearly, I mean, in a sense, you know, the state regulates. And so, I mean, they're honest enough. I don't think that's going to be an issue. And then obviously the other thing about exiting the game, there are people who can't exit the game.
You can walk out of a movie anytime you want, but not necessarily out of a gambling addiction.
And so that's what really does concern me.
Jerry, thanks for your call. Dave's on the line. Welcome, Dave. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I want to make three quick points, one or two of which might have been anticipated, but I'll be quick.
Go.
First, I think that the phenomenon suggests the feeling among people that the questionableness of the ideology of opportunity and of the possibility of getting rich, which is supposed to be so much part of the experience of being an American.
I mean, that's the American ideal, but yet if you don't feel like you have a real shot at it, you turn to gambling.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the second point has to do with that, the reaction to the fact that you need, as I heard on the news just an hour or two before, you need in this area $21 an hour just to rent a two-bedroom apartment and put food on the table.
And not everybody has it.
Right. And three, this has been somewhat anticipated, but I'll mention it. State lotteries are a conscious, cynical, regressive snare and delusion put before the public because legislators don't want or can't tax the rich. And in that context, I'd like to say that as I understand it, the total household wealth of this country is something like $32 trillion, 40% of which is owned by the richest 1% of families. That's something like $12 or $13 trillion, I believe. It's bigger than my understanding is. It's bigger than the gross domestic product.
So there's a lot right up at the top. Our time is short, Dave, but you raise great points. Thank you for making them. Richard McGowan, what about this? Dave raises the picture as of gambling as being almost a way for many Americans to virtually live out the American dream. They cannot actually achieve it, but every time they scratch that ticket, there's the possibility that they'll be part of it. Is it helping Americans migrate into a kind of dream world?
Well, people gamble what they dream about. So, for instance, the daily number, again, as I mentioned earlier, is are the poorer people and the elderly. And winning $500 would make a difference in their lives. The middle class love to play the lotto, where there's 6 out of 49 numbers where you can win millions. Again, notice the people who play that, they play it in order to because that can make a difference in their lives.
So it all depends what you've got. If $500 isn't a big deal, you don't play on it. But if you want to dream about $10 million or $100 million,
and those and people who go down to casino, they obviously want to be entertained. And there, I think I think the games you play very much depends on. Ironically, the worst payout in a casino are nickel slot machines.
There it is. Let's get one more call. Bruce is on the line. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi.
Make it quick, Bruce. We're almost out of time.
Okay. Well, I'd like to say that the whole premise of this show is pretty absurd.
In what sense, Bruce?
There's no doubt that there's too much gambling going on.
That's the question.
My ex-wife was a gambling addict, and she lost the custody of our kids to me because she did gamble. She lost the rent money several times, and my daughter was, I was in the Air Force at the time, and I was on temporary duty in Germany. My daughter was forced to call my parents by her to get some money so that they wouldn't get kicked out of their apartment.
Bruce, I have to apologize because our time is up, but you bring it right home to us. Gambling drove a truck right through your life. Thank you for your call. I'm sorry it's so short. Richard McGowan, you know, here's the voice that says, of course it's too much. It ruined my family.
And again, I mean, and yet there'd be some people in the industry who would respond to him by saying, look, 98% of the people can do it responsibly. And there's, I think, the real, but I think, as he pointed out there, we definitely have a responsibility to the people who get addicted to it. And that, there's the interesting question. You know, we have not done nearly enough.
Given all the money,
that
floats on this great riverboat. Richard McGowan, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's been a pleasure.
Richard McGowan is economics professor at Boston College. His author most recently of Government and the Transformation of the Gaming Industry. In a moment, networks and cable take a gamble with a new season of television. This is On Point. September means the end of summer, the beginning of a new school year, football games and turning leaves. It also means a new season of television. A new slew of shows are making their debut on both network and cable. To give us the trends, hopeful hits, and inevitable flops, we're joined by Bob Thompson, director for the Center of Popular Television at Syracuse University. Good evening and welcome, Bob Thompson.
Thank you.
Bob, what do you see as the big trends in the fall lineup on television this season?
Well, I suppose the first response I would have is there's not a single thing being introduced on the networks that I think anybody would say you've absolutely got to watch. This is a time when the networks most desperately need the next big idea, and it doesn't seem to be in the schedule. But there are these little nodules of trends and similarities that we can see.
One of the big ones, I guess, is nostalgia, or at least looking backward.
Yeah, and I think there's a whole number of reasons for this. Number one, for the last 30, 40 years, we've been on a 20-year nostalgia cycle anyway. In the 90s, we were looking back to the 70s. In the 70s, for that matter, some of the top shows on TV were MASH and Happy Days set in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew the 80s were coming back. We've seen harbingers of this with that 80s show, which actually tanked. And I'm hearing a lot more Air Supply on the radios than I used to just a couple of years ago. So the 80s are coming back, and this time we've got two. That was Then and Do Over, both of which take place at either end of the decade. And then, of course, we've got American Dreams, which goes all the way back to the 1960s, not to mention two shows that are being resuscitated from the past of television, Family Affair, which is doing pretty well, and Twilight Zone.
What were the TV executives thinking that made them turn to the 80s and the past for this season?
Well, I think there were two things. One is they were figuring the time is about right for 80s nostalgia, and they might be right about that. The other thing was the Carol Burnett Show did really good business back in October. It got 30 million viewers, more than anybody ever expected. And most people said it was because people wanted the comfort food of that kind of TV after September 11th. So I think the idea was that Carol Burnett's success spurred them on thinking, maybe this is it. Maybe the future of our networks isn't its future, isn't its present, but is in fact its past.
So we have the image of Americans looking back to the Cold War time, the period of nuclear threat, for comfort. It's an odd thing.
Well, it is quite odd. I mean, there is this sense that now, all of a sudden, those nice and warm, fuzzy days of the Cold War maybe aren't looking so bad to some people.
And do they manage to find any gold there from the viewer's vantage?
Well, American Dreams is kind of interesting. The very fact that they're actually using clips from American Bandstand is kind of a cool idea. The idea that you would take an old show and be able to work it into a new one. So far, however, one doesn't see anything in any of these three shows that says this is what's going to compete with The Sopranos for the heart of the American critic.
The show we hear about somehow in the reality television category is Push Nevada, but it's not reality as in Survivor, as unreal as that may have been.
No, Push Nevada is reality only insofar as there's a game attached to it. If you can solve the mystery of where the money is that everybody's looking for, you conceivably could win over $1 million yourself, and you've got to be looking for the clues.
What's the plot here or the gambit that this game is part of, Bob?
Well, there's this money missing, and an IRS guy is looking for it, and there's all of these levels of evil, a lot like Twin Peaks, which it kind of reminds me of.
Hmm.
And it's a pretty fast show, very stylized, and actually kind of a lot of fun. Here's its problem. Number one, it's got the worst time slot in all of television. Thursday night up against the must-see TV lineup. And if that weren't bad enough on CBS, it's up against CSI, which has been the number one or two program consistently throughout the last season. Secondly, the whole game element depends upon real careful viewing. And as we know, except for your very few favorite stories, most TV one watches in a state of drowsy, weak, passive, you know, you're half asleep. And to a great extent, this show may just not work. It's a pretty good show. It's a pretty good idea. But you've got to pay attention. And I'm not sure anybody is going to be that committed to it until it's too late.
But someone will pay attention. And I guess eventually, it said, win $1 million by solving the mystery.
Right. That's one of the things that's made Push Nevada one of the only new shows that people are really talking about much. My guess is that if they didn't have that game element, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
And there's the cable versus network dynamic, once again, with the cable categories making a lot of noise.
Yeah, all of the excitement is going on in the test kitchens of cable now. It's where all the new mutations, all the new innovations are happening. And we've seen it in complete turnaround. A show called Monk, which ABC passed on a while back, was then picked up by cable. And now ABC is going to show it in its second run. So the networks are now picking up the table scraps of cable, not the other way around. When you look at the big story of last year, The Osbournes on MTV, a cable show, some of the innovative comedies like Jon Stewart and South Park were on Comedy Central. And, of course, the biggest story in all of television as far as quality is concerned is clearly HBO.
So why do you think it's the networks that came up with going back to nostalgia and not cable? What is it about the network audience or executive mindset that would push them back to Happy Days style?
Well, I think for one thing, the networks is still the department store. HBO, Showtime, MTV are specialty boutiques, so to speak. Network TV is still, while it's looking for that desirable 18 to 34-year-old, is also looking for everybody to watch it. And I think the idea is now, after we've woken up from this lovely dream of multiplying retirement plans, no Cold War, and all of the rest of it of the 1990s, now we're suddenly in a war on terrorism. We don't know where our retirement money is going to come from. And suddenly this notion of kind of going back to a universe when none of this had happened yet seems appealing to viewers in the eyes of network executives, just like going back to the 50s seemed appealing after Watergate and the loss of the Vietnam War did in the 1970s.
So 500 channels, a lot of stuff on. What are you going to be watching this fall, Bob Thompson?
Well, it's my job to try to watch a little bit of all of this stuff. And sometimes with some of these new comedies especially, I'm going to really feel like I'm earning my living.
We appreciate you earning that living and bringing news back from the front. Bob Thompson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bob Thompson is director at the Center for Popular Television at Syracuse University. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amada, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. A special tip of the hat tonight to Nate DeMayo. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...